It's really nice to speak. I never give papers at the British Home Office, so it's really nice to be invited. I want to say thank you very much to Emma for organising this week's event. I know that I'm not the last speaker, there's more to come, but it's been a fantastic meeting so far, and I hope I don't ruin it. That's all I can say. One quick thing, I apologise. Can I ask you not to take photographs of any slides that have got handwritten documents in, because I have to get permission from the Essex Record Office to show them. And it's a copyright issue, but I'd be grateful if you didn't do that. This paper emerges out of research I've been doing, trying to recover the lives of early modern people and the animals they lived and worked with. These are the mundane ones and not the toads called Philip and things like that. Most of the people who lived and worked closely with animals were likely to be illiterate in this period, and they've left us little more than some of their non-human co-workers, whose bone remains are all that we have of them. There's no letters or diaries, for example, from many of these people. And like Victoria, I've had to go to legal documents to track their lives. But what I've been looking at are wills, and I've just finished a book project that has been based on an analysis of 4,444 wills written by, that's a pure chance it was that number, written by inhabitants of Essex during the period 1620 and 1635. I chose that period partly because it's a period before the Civil War when things can go wrong in terms of record keeping, but also because in this period there was an idea that 15 years was the age of a dairy cow, and so it seemed like a good period to choose. What the wills can tell us is really valuable, and I think it's, hopefully I'll make the case that it's not simply about the property status of animals. I'm not a statistical historian, most of you will already know that. I had such trouble with my Excel spreadsheets, you won't believe. So I was going for the qualitative rather than the quantitative data. But there were times when the figures were very telling. And so this paper begins with some numbers. I feel like, my God, look at me. And we move from these numbers to explore some more kind of cultural and imaginative ways of thinking about the animals. I hope that disappearing down this strange rabbit hole called the 17th century, we might actually come out towards the end of the paper when I'll start to think, well, what does this mean for us to thinking about agricultural animals today? So, of the 451 wills in the data set that included animals, that is less, just over 10%, 288 of them, that's a will, 288% of them, that's 64%, left quick cattle, that's the early modern term for livestock. Livestock is a word that comes in later in the 17th century. They left them to legatees who were described in the will as sons, daughters, nephews, nieces, grandchildren, godchildren, and the children of neighbours or other kin. That might seem obvious. Bequests in a will are always likely to go to a younger generation, even in a society in which mortality rates are high and longevity unlikely. But there's more that can be read into the bequeathing of animals to children. And what's particularly interesting is how testators bequeath young animals to children. And it's the correlation of those two, the younger generation of humans and the younger generation of animals, that I think we might begin to uncover something that is perhaps alien to our way of thinking about agricultural animals. By the meaning of agricultural animals, what I mean by that is that how they were regarded in this period was simply more than material creatures. This is the case I'm going to make. I think they had more than economic and practical value. So when you're working with an animal, you're working with more than the practicalities of life. So, some figures. Of the 90 wills in the data set that include bequests of lambs, 65 have legatees who are children, 72%. Of the 69 of the 98 wills that include calves, young bovine animals, leave them to legatees who are children. 44 wills include colts, and 48% leave them to children, and the 20 wills that refer to piglets, 45% do the same. These figures suggest a number of things. It's plausible that, except at the highest end of the social scale, horses would be more likely to have adult riders, and this use is reflected in testamentary practices. Pigs were not often specifically referred to in wills generally, And when they are, the lower proportion of child legatees might reflect that young pigs were regarded as somewhat independent residents of the yard, feeding from their mother's milk and then foraging for much of their own food, and otherwise living off household scraps. So caring for these creatures may have been understood to be different from looking after other young animals, to have required less exercise of skill. And this, I think, could have had an impact on who was bequeathed them. The fact that of all animals, pigs are most likely to be slaughtered at home might also play a part, and I'll come back to that. We can drill down even further into the bequeathing of young animals in these wills by looking at how the individual legatees are described by the testator. So these figures are of wills. I'm now going to turn to the number of legatees. So here, a clear difference in bequeathing patterns can be traced again. So all 14 of the legatees who fall into the category children who were left young swine are the immediate offspring of the testator. Of the 21 children bequeathed colts, 95% are sons and daughters of the testator. Of the 93 individual child legatees who are left young bovids, 78% are named as immediate offspring of the testator. Of the 123 children who are bequeathed lambs, only 35 of them, so 28%, are the immediate children of the testator. So there's a big difference. Lambs were more likely than all other young animals to be left to children who were not the testator's immediate offspring. Okay. The distinctive nature of the pattern of bequeathing land can be tracked even further using the wills themselves, as they offer the age evidence of the age of child legatees. So a child listed as married or as having their own children is clearly an adult, for example. So far I've just been including them as a category child. We can also go to parish registers and find records of the baptism dates of some of the children to know how old they are. And that can act as an equivalent. Just to show you that I struggle in research, this is a nice tidy will from 1613 Great Braxted, in which John Birch leaves his son a lamb. How do we know how old John Birch is? We go to the parish register, and then back 15 years, we find somebody called John Birch with a child. You just have to search. There is no type in the name and it turns up. You just I suffered for my art. You need to know about this. Okay. All right. So tracking the age of children, going a little bit further than we've gone before. So there's John Birch's son, Thomas. From this, it's possible then to get down some more, even deeper into the statistics. So of the 10 children bequeathed young pigs, the age of 4 can't be confirmed with any of the records, while the other 6 are all over 18. Of the 21 child legatees, recipients of colts, the age of 8 can't be confirmed, but of the remaining 13, 12 are over 18. The age of 43 of the 93 children bequeathed young bovids can't be determined, but of the remaining 50, 33 were over 18. However, with the lambs, yet again, we get something very different. Of the 123 children left lambs, 66 of them cannot be given a specific age, but of the remaining 57, 23% were adults at the time the will was written, while 77% were children under the age of 18. In addition, if we go even deeper, I can find you the specific age using the baptism records of some of the children. 19 individual child recipients of bovid and 26 of lambs I can give exact ages to. The average age of a child receiving a calf is 8 years, 8 months, while the average age of a child receiving a lamb is 5 years, 5 months. It's a very small sample. I don't want to cling to that, but it's interesting. All right, so on the basis of these statistics, I think it's worth asking why lambs were so much more likely to be bequeathed to children who can be confirmed as being under the age of 18 than any other young animal, and why it appears those children might have been younger on average than the under 18-year-olds bequeathed young bovids. I'm using bovid rather than cattle because I think William said yesterday cattle is a general term in this period. Issues of practicality are obviously crucial. Leaving a young child a fully grown cow was possible, of course, but it's unlikely that the child would have been expected to take care of that animal, him or herself. And indeed, often the cow was noted as not to be delivered to the young legatee until they reached adulthood. Thus, for example, Thomas Burr of St. Osyth bequeathed to Thomas Burr, John Burr and Richard Burr, his sons, to every one of them to be delivered to them at their several ages of one, and a cow to be delivered to them at their several ages of 1 and 20 years. So this is a looking ahead. What was being left in such a bequest was not so much the animal's value to the legatee at the moment of writing the will as its potential for future usefulness. This is also the case when young bovids are bequeathed to children, something acknowledged by John Wallace, a husbandman from Great Chisel, for example, when he bequeathed to his son Thomas, my red bullock, being a 2-year-old bullock at the next spring, hoping that my wife will keep and bring up the same bullock until some profitable increase thereby cometh to my son Thomas. Now, while a bullock such as this might be destined in time for the market as meat, and so represent a short-term gain with the sale price coming to the child, the young animal might also have the potential to become part of a dairy herd. Bullock could be female in this period. This would mean that it's possible that this bullock could have a role to play in the child's upbringing in terms of the nutritional value to the household of her meek, but also the economic value of her calves. And it's this that might be her profitable increase. In addition, if a dairy cow could work for up to 15 years, which was stated, what was bequeathed could also be a longer-term investment in the child's future. Thomas Wallace was 11 years old when his father died, and it might be that he would not use the not-yet 2-year-old bullock as the start of his own dairy herd in years to come. So the potential for the long-term productivity holds true for sheep in this period too. Thomas Tusser, one of the most popular agricultural writers of the period, advised that eating lambs was very, very poor accounting, that the profit in them was in wool and not meat. For this reason, young male lambs not required for reproductive purposes were castrated, were termed wethers, and were raised for wool and only finally for flesh. Ewe lambs, of course, had a future quadruple productivity. Their wool, their production of lambs, their milk, and ultimately their flesh. So in practical terms, and you should know, there's almost no uncastrated male animals in wills in this period. I think it's 2 or 3 bulls in the whole of Essex in 15 years. Now, not everybody wrote a will, but it's significant that there's hundreds of cows and very few bulls, and the same with rams. In practical terms, then, those testators who bequeathed a lamb to a child were offering a legacy that would have been of small value at the time of writing the will, but had potential for profit over the longer term. This could also, I think, be read in another way, too. So we meet William Hutley, a yeoman of Little Easton, laid down in his will that his wife Margaret, quote, shall keep for our said son every year during his nonage one sheep and one lamb. And so what he was leaving 9-year-old John was the beginning of his own flock. But this bequest should not only be read as providing him with a valuable resource. It should also be interpreted as allowing John to learn his future trade on a small scale, watching over the lambs, even if from a distance, as they were tended most closely by their mothers or by a shepherd, would introduce this young legatee to the occupation he would be likely to enter as he grew up, and might reveal the legacy to have a hands-on rather than just an economic value. But there's even more to bequeathing a lamb than even these practicalities. 19 child legatees receiving lambs, that is over 16% of all child bequests of lands, were named as godchildren of the testator. By comparison, only 2 child recipients of young bovids were named as godchildren, that's 2% of those bequests. No other young animal was given to a godchild. Baptismal registers do not record the names of godparents, so we can't track that any further. Thus, the bequeathing of lambs is yet again anomalous. And I think this is worth pausing over, because I think it's here with the godchildren that we might find an otherwise hidden aspect of early modern husbandry. The role of godparents was set out in this period, as it is now in the Church of England, in the service of baptism in the Book of Common Prayer, where they were asked not only to stand in the place of the newborn and declare the infant's faith on his or her behalf, in its adjectival form, infans in Latin, is Latin for without language. Godparents were also presented as the child's sureties, guarantors that they would. The child would learn the creed, the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, the Ten Sermons, and that, quote, these children may be virtuously brought up to lead a godly and Christian life. In the theology of the Church of England, baptism did not effect the child's possession of grace. In Protestant theology, no human act could do that. It symbolised it. And I suggest that the bequeathing of lambs to godchildren might have had a similar purpose. Thus, when John Green of Wormingford bequeathed to his two godchildren, Mary Green, daughter of my son William, and George Pilgrim, either of them a lamb, what he was giving was this surety in animal form. And this works on a number of intertwined levels. An intertwining, I think, that reveals a crucial link between husbandry and symbolism in this period. First and obviously, there is an unmistakable connection being made between the lamb and the child, with the lamb held up as an ideal infant. Edward Topsell, the vicar, who was the author of the 1607 History of Four-Footed Beasts, for example, followed the tradition of 12th century bestiaries when he noted the lamb's ability to, quote, discern the voice of his parents when lost amid a flock of thousands. This behaviour, of course, can be observed in actual lambs, but Topsell's 17th century readers were perhaps also being asked to recall the true, that is, natural obedience of that other lamb, Christ, and to bring to mind their own very human capacity to stray. Indeed, because Protestant theology assumed the innate corruption of all humans from birth, links between the young Ovid and the young human based on their shared innocence is unlikely to be present in Topsell's work, as the hugely popular 17th century work, The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven, by Arthur Dent put it, "We are by nature the children of wrath." And if you're a fan of science fiction, Henry Bully, you will know that Arthur Dent in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, not The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven, is named after that Essex vicar, Arthur Dent. That is true. Arthur Dent said, "We are by nature the children of wrath." So rather than appealing to their potential for self-perfectibility, Protestant authors urged the individual Christian to put their faith in the forgiveness of their Creator, a faith that found its way into wills. As the Stansted Mount Fitchett yeoman John Eliot makes clear when he writes, "I bequeath my soul into the merciful hands and protection of Almighty God, my Creator, and of Jesus Christ, Saviour and Redeemer of all mankind, trusting assuredly and by and through the merits, love and intercession of the same Jesus Christ to have remission of all my sins and thereby to obtain eternal life." Statements like this are only made in Protestant wills. You don't get Catholic wills in this period because it's illegal to be a Catholic, but you can get wills that are less overtly Protestant than that. So at the conclusion of Topsell's Discourse of the Lamb, he notes that the greatest honour thereof is for that it pleased God to call his blessed Son, our Saviour, by the name of a lamb in the Old Testament, a lamb for sacrifice, and in the New Testament, starred by John the Baptist, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. Such an understanding would have been familiar to parishioners from sermons, and it might mean that the bequest of a lamb, in addition to having a worldly significance, was giving the child an emblem of Christ, and was thus a preparation for the death that existed in the midst of life, and was also a marker of the child's potential to be saved. A godparent leaving a lamb to a godchild was thus offering as well as a valuable thing and the potential for the training of the child in their future profession, a kind of homely introduction to soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. Alongside its practical value, therefore, the symbolic link of a lamb with Christ may have meant that this young creature, rather than any other, was felt to be the most appropriate to bequeath to a godchild. Calves, for example, did not possess these relevant emblematic meanings. Indeed, Topsell notes that they are, quote, "exceedingly given to sport and wantonness," unquote. The bequest of a lamb, you might say, reinforced the relationship between the godparent and the godchild, even as death was about to end it. In addition, of course, it was also offering the child a preparation for mortality in another way. It was providing a context in which the actual deaths of animals could become part of the child's life. Now, once again, this aspect of the bequest is not only practical. Children are not only being taught that animals will and perhaps have to die. In addition, the bequest of a lamb might begin to help the child to see the meaning of killing. because it had a meaning that went beyond practicality. The lamb, a young creature that is being, that all being well, the child would see grow older, could introduce the child to the way in which care had to be coupled with killing in agricultural production. But more than that, even, I suggest that the bequest of a lamb to a godchild allows us to see that in this period, killing animals was regarded as possessing a meaning that, again, went beyond the practical. Now, killing animals is something that casts its shadow over all human livestock relations. We've already talked about this. It is, as the classical historian Jeremy McKinney has noted, the paradox at the heart of pastoralism. In distinction from hunter-gatherer societies, pastoral cultures, he writes, face a problem. Farmers engage in what he represents as the parental relationship with their livestock, in their overseeing of their breeding and rearing. And thus, he says, killing a domesticated animal is tinged with betrayal in ways that would never trouble a hunter. Unquote. For the ancient Greeks, McKinney argues, sacrifice resolved the paradox of pastoralism. It gave meaning to the deaths of domestic animals by giving those deaths a sacred status. In early 17th century Essex, Protestant theology was for most the spiritual narrative that was used to explain human mortality. And writing a will played a role in that process of an individual's preparation for and acceptance of death. How or whether an animal prepared for its death is not a question that can be answered, of course, but how the human who lived with, worked with, and cared for that animal prepared for its death is something we can get a glimpse of. Indeed, the killing the animals with whom the husbandman and his wife and their children worked day in, day out, is, I suspect, central to how they lived with them. And without understanding that aspect of husbandry, we cannot fully comprehend what husbandry was back then. With many animals, after all, keeping them alive and healthy, a key focus of the day-to-day life that required paying attention to them and was sometimes premised on the individualisation of those animals, that was necessary only as a precursor to killing them. And this issue can be understood, I think, through the sense of animals that emerges from bequests of lambs to godchildren. Now, human dominion, of course, was decreed in the Bible, so you might think this is what people go back to. Genesis 1:28 reads, "And God blessed Adam and Eve, and the God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living creature that moves upon the earth." So in theory, therefore, things were clear. The creatures, Henry Vesey wrote in 1621, the creatures were not made for themselves, but for the service and use of man. That's nice clarity, but in practice, things were more complicated. The service and use of animals in agriculture had to include collegiality across species barriers. People had to get to know some of their animals very well in order to work productively with them. And the use of animals also involved the acknowledgement of, and more the reliance on, the fact that those animals themselves could experience experiences and that those experiences needed to be factored into husbandry practices. In this world, the claim for the straightforward human right to exercise power over the so-called lower animals was therefore somewhat less helpful in explaining the killing of them than it might seem to be. The animals people worked with, who I found were understood by those who worked alongside them to have strong moral values, to have powerful maternal instincts, and to be potentially unruly, were clearly also made for themselves, to use Vesey's words. And utilising the fact that they were made for themselves was actually part of the process of good husbandry. In the yard, therefore, the theory of dominion would have been present, but it would have had to sit alongside the sense of one-to-one personal engagement between people and their quick cattle, which would have made the claim to a human right to use them more complicated than biblical injunction would seem to imply. And the significance of that personal engagement cannot be dismissed. To ask how it was possible that the testators of early 17th century Essex might look a pig in the eye and knock it on the head with a poleaxe is not, therefore, to force onto early modern culture a modern sentiment which emerges out of the distance between consumer and meat animal that many people take for granted nowadays in the West. Rather, I think the question is appropriate because the difficulty of living with and killing animals is an unavoidable product of the closeness that early modern people experienced in their relationships with them. And it's inevitable given their belief that the animals themselves experienced those relationships too. Indeed, to turn it around, if we assume that early modern people found slaughtering their animals unproblematic, we would seem by implication to be anaesthetising those people, making them incapable of feeling. And this, I think, would be misreading the past. And yet, of course, they killed their animals. So this is the interesting part. John Berger famously offers a way of thinking about this. Writing about 20th century rural French culture, he proposed, quote, a peasant becomes fond of his pig and is glad to salt away its pork, arguing that, quote, what is significant and so difficult for the urban stranger to understand is that the two statements in that sentence are connected by an and not by a but, unquote. Now, I am dubious, I have always been dubious about the simplicity of Berger's reading, about the romanticisation, I think, of fairly modern agriculture that I think it contains. I don't think it's as straightforward as his representation implies for so-called peasants in the modern world. But I do think that Berger's idea works for the early modern testators. I have been studying them. For them, fondness and killing is joined by an and not by a but. And that and that existed back then was available because those people had access to a realm of meaning that allowed an animal's death to have more than practical significance. So we've got the significance of the lamb is more than practical in the bequest, and I think killing animals has a significance. Indeed, it's the very juxtaposition of conversation and killing in early modern husbandry that affords us the final, perhaps even the ultimate, glimpse of why a bequest of a lamb to a godchild is important. So the and, John Berger's and that links fondness and killing in the early 17th century yards and fields of Essex is the more than worldly meaning of animals. What allows for the killing of an animal who might be individualised and perhaps even named to be more than just morally problematic is the fact that killing it is part of its meaning to the farmer, because it also, importantly, is part of its divinely ordained meaning. And this can be found perhaps most clearly in the reading of meat that can be found in religious work from the period. In the Protestant thinking of the early 17th century, animal flesh seems to have a transcendent quality. It is figured as a reminder of human fleshiness, in that it recalls to the eater to their position as beings of earth, even as their eating of meat would seem to be evidence of their dominion and so of their superiority and difference. In this context, consuming animal flesh has a value beyond money or nutrition, beyond sale and consumption. And so I'm just going to offer one example. In sermons given in 1628 and published in 1639, John Paget saw meat eating in uncompromising and yet utterly emblematic terms. So this is what he says. Our food is not only of corruption, but we feed even of death itself. This is for you, Gary, and Henry. We feed even of death itself. And that by the allowance of God, Genesis 9:3, in taking away the life of other creatures to maintain our own, especially in these last times when he hath said unto us of them all, rise, kill and eat, Acts 10:13, whatsoever is sold in the shambles, that eat, asking no question, for conscience sake, 1 Corinthians 10:25. Herein we see death daily presented to us and set before us on our tables. This is seriously to be thought upon as a wonderful work of God. By the death of other creatures, our life is preserved, our living bodies are sustained by their dead carcasses. In their blood swims our life, and from their pangs of death spring the pleasures of our life, our feasts, and ordinary food. So for Paget, the problem of flesh is the meaning of flesh. And as such, it's tempting to see his argument as an early version of staying with the trouble. Although I think that's probably all he would have in common with Donna Haraway. In the logic that underpins Paget's work, to become a vegetarian would be to stop living what's called the living language of the creator, which you stop reading the living language of the creator, which is the natural world. which would in turn make animals' lives and deaths meaningless. It would be to turn away from something that was a wonderful work of divine will. And that is what the animals are for the service and use of man in the field, but also on the dinner table. Their use was material, and their material value was inseparable from the immaterial meaning it conveyed. But Paget goes even further, arguing that those who were distant from killing should engage in a particularly active kind of contemplation in order to achieve knowledge of the divine. So he says, the gentleman that sits at his table above in his dining chamber and was not present in the kitchen or butchery to see the execution, the convulsions of death, the sprinting and gasping of the slaughtered creatures, is yet by remembrance to represent the same and to make it present again in his eating. For eating and burying of them in our bellies is more than killing of them, and a further means to strike the heart with thought of death procured for the eater. So how a gentleman might by remembrance make the butchery presence not clear, perhaps the implication is that everyone in this period has actually seen an animal being killed and they to bring that in mind. Or maybe it is just the very language of Paget's sermon, its emphasis on the sprinting and the gasping of the slaughtered creatures, that is, like a good sermon should, bringing back to life the death throes of the creature. But the remembrance might also call up an empathetic contemplation of all that we share with animals. The creature's flesh is a means to strike the heart with thought of death. The call to represent slaughter to oneself at the dinner table should thus be read as a call to imagine one's own mortality and one's own edible fleshiness. And so eating meat is a memento mori. Not only does it remind the eater that in the midst of life we are in death, it also asks us to consider, and we've already had this question of being worms, and it's asking us to consider the fact that we are all, as Shakespeare knew, food for worms. It reinforces rather than veils the shared mortality, fleshiness, meatiness of humans and animals. So thus we can see in this period, killing animals like bequeathing lands carries a worldly and otherworldly meaning. What we find in the yards and fields of early modern Essex is the experience of discomfort at the death of one's animals, something that's being prepared for in every bequest of a lamb, should be understood as a core part of the animal's function. It's not something that should be turned away from or repressed. To return to Burge's image, the and in early modern Essex is the symbolic resonance that is so daily a part of people's perception of their animal. It is the fact that killing them can be conceived as meaningful because it is troubling that makes sense of the killing of an animal you care for. In this way, the and for early modern people does not paper over a crack, making the slaughter of animals unproblematically part of the relationship with them. It actually makes the problem, the trouble of killing, very real, very powerful, and very meaningful. As in the sacrificial culture of ancient Greece, the means of addressing the problem of killing back then also looked outside of animals to find a meaning, to the realm of the supernatural, to religion. The worldview, however, that's currently in place to explain husbandry does something very different. And I think it's here that we can see that Burgess' sense that there's an and that links fondness and killing becomes a bit of a romanticisation. Okay, so this is where I try to kind of pull myself back from the 17th century. It might be argued that animal welfare science, for example, presents the meaning of animals now as existing within the animals themselves. There is no need to invoke the supernatural here. Rather, it's animals' consciousness, agency, feelings, you might say, that are important, not their status as exemplars or symbols of an external divine authority. And in this context, killing them can only be regarded as taking from them, violently or otherwise, that which makes them who they are. Slaughter is no longer a fulfillment of a divine narrative. It is not the completion of the animal's inseparably worldly and otherworldly role. Killing is just the curtailing of the life of an experiencing being who has skills, competences, and desires. It is difficult, therefore, to see how fondness and killing can be comfortably joined in this context. Studies of current agriculture underline my sense that John Burge's reading of the peasant's relationship with his pig might be a kind of romanticising of it. As empirical science has emerged as the dominant discourse when dealing with animals since the late 16th century, so the period I'm looking at is the moment when new science is taking over from old science. And as the intensification of farming took place, the mid-17th century on is the period where large farms take over from small farms. So again, I'm at the end of that period of family farms. So the emblematic worldview, as it's called, lost its place. Animals emerge into this new world as material beings with use value. And the husbandry practices that required and relied on closeness, long-term engagement, individualisation, increasingly found themselves with only a but to link caring and killing. There is still trouble. People have not become anaesthetised to the necessary slaughter of the animals they care for, but the trouble is harder to make meaningful. Studies by current sociologists of agriculture, for example, show that those people directly involved with animals have not simply taken up an economistic view in which the mechanistic perspective of animals is replaced by the assumption of an automated, rule-based causation between physical elements, as Françoise Wemmelsfelder describes that mechanistic perspective. Such a perspective might remove the horror of slaughter, as Descartes himself wrote in 1649, when he defended his hypothesis that animals were God's automata, lacking the cognitive capacity to experience pain, by saying, "My opinion is not so much cruel to animals as indulgent to human beings, since it absolves them from the suspicion of crime when they eat or kill animals." This is how he defended the animal automata. Despite the theoretical dominance of the perspective that emerges from Cartesian thinking, current farmers and slaughterhouse workers, like the early modern forebears, often engage with animals as co-workers rather than as objects. And the discomfort caused by the need to recommodify an animal, to shift it from being an individual with whom one has an emotional relationship to a product that is saleable, can only be made worse by the growing scientific understanding of and welfare attention being paid to their possessing what John Webster has termed feelings that matter. Rhoda Wilkie's work shows how distancing manoeuvres are sought by the people who work with livestock at the moment they begin their journey to the slaughterhouse, for example. And likewise, Mark Riley has looked at dairy farmers' experience of retirement and the impact that that has on their animals. And he's noted that preparing animals for sale is, quote, not simply material, that is preparation through grooming or fattening animals, but also discursive. It requires the production of, quote, one or more strategies to allow a moral and empirical separation from the animal as it became positioned as a commodity, unquote. Ensuring that the connecting word in the sentence, a peasant becomes fond of his pig and is glad to salt away its pork, remains an and not a but, does not appear to be easy anymore. John Webster has noted that overworked farmers can become habituated to certain behaviours in their animals which they see every day. The limping cow, he says, is seen as normal. As consumers, we are also habituated to what we see all the time, as Carol Adams knew, a habituation to pre-packaged meat in fridges that look nothing like animals, distances eating meat from the animal itself. I wonder if the unfamiliar world of 17th century men, women, children and animals might provide a way in which what we are accustomed to today might be defamiliarised, might be seen in a new light. Writing about the power of art at the beginning of the 20th century, Viktor Shklovsky argued that, quote, art exists that one may recover the sensation of life. It exists to make one feel things, to make the stone stony, unquote. I wonder if the history of animals might do something similar. Studying past cultures is not a way of opening up a nostalgic look back on a lost world of agriculture. I think it was probably pretty hideous being an animal back then. I also think it was pretty hideous being a human back then for most of the people. Nor is it suggesting that this is a golden age of small production that we might return to. We've already mentioned this. That's impossible. It's not going to happen. Having a sense of how things were might ask us to wonder what it is we do now. in a world in which what we do is so difficult to make coherent. So when in 1621, Robert Scarlett, a husbandman from Goldhanger, bequeathed, quote, unto my son, the son of John, unto my godson, the son of John Grant, one ewe lamb, he was perhaps leaving us something too. For him, a lamb was an and, a creature to be interpreted in more than material terms, however difficult, as even Rembrandt knew, those terms might have been to stomach back then. Thank you.